This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat.
I don't really know how to label myself. I just tell people, my dad's Nigerian from Nigeria. My mom's Vietnamese from Vietnam. I was born in Vietnam. Call me whatever you want, because everywhere I go, I get called something different, you know? Mixed Miyagi, based in Tampa, Florida. I'm all here with the Vietnamese podcast with my man, Kenneth, man.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Miyagi, thank you so much. It's been a long time in the making. Thank you for coming on today.
Yeah, for real, right?
You know, you got a fascinating origin story, and I'd like to take it back. I know you were born in Vietnam. Can we talk about how your parents met?
My dad's Nigerian. So a lot of people ask me, they're like, oh, so you're half black. I'm like, it's not the same thing, you know? There's a difference between an African-American and an African, you know what I'm saying? So yeah, my dad was born and raised in Nigeria, left Nigeria when he was about 18.
Before you go on, let's really talk about that difference, because a lot of people don't understand that difference. Okay. I didn't understand that difference. So what I understand is the DOS part, right? There's a thing called DOS. African-Americans are DOS, which is descendants of slaves. And Nigerian Africans, people from Africa, it's a very different history. It's a very different mindset almost. And is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, but I've actually never heard of the term DOS, descendant of slaves, at all. I just mean as far as like culture, character, the way they talk, the way they carry themselves, their way of thinking, it's completely different. It's black and white. People think just like black people in the US, you know, oh, it would be the same as like African. No, they're completely different. Honestly, if I were, for lack of better words, I would say Africans probably look down on, you know, like African Americans here in the US because of the history. Obviously, like, they just lost touch with the African side, you know?
Mm-hmm. How do you know all this? I mean, because you're an African-American, right? Do you consider yourself African-American, or do you consider yourself a son of a Nigerian African person?
To be honest, I don't really know how to label myself. I just tell people, my dad's Nigerian from Nigeria. My mom's Vietnamese from Vietnam. I was born in Vietnam. Call me whatever you want, because everywhere I go, I get called something different, you know? So here, my homies in the US, they always look at me as like, oh, Miyagi's Asian. But when I go to Vietnam, they're like, oh, he's an American. But when I go visit, you know, my dad's side over in the UK, they're like, oh, he's American. You know what I mean? Like, I get pushed in all different sorts of labels and stuff. I just tell people, like, hey, my dad's from the motherland. Me and my mom are from the motherland. No one in my family to this date has been born in America. We've all came over. We're all born overseas and came over. So, yeah.
Yeah, these distinctions are interesting. Fascinating to me. Yeah.
No, yeah,
sorry to cut you off. Yeah, mom and dad.
Oh, yeah.
They met in Vietnam.
Oh yes. Yeah. So like I was saying, my dad was very educated, and there's really only two ways to make it out of, well, three ways to make it out of Nigeria. If you're super athletic and you like play like soccer or something, you're really educated, very smart. You can leave on scholarship and go to other countries, attend university. And three, like, your family's just rich. He's got money. He got bread, you know? So, my dad left Nigeria to go to the UK first for education. Ended up going to several other European countries for education. Ended up accumulating 7 degrees in, in several countries. He ended up speaking, like, 5 languages and stuff. So how he ended up in Vietnam, Before he went to Vietnam, he actually settled in the US, and the last university that he attended and got a degree in was one right here in Tampa, where I live in now. That's the University of South Florida, which as I grew up, I ended up going to as well. But my dad, I want to say he probably been through like two divorces or whatnot. And he somehow just found himself just going to Vietnam, got a job teaching English and economics at the University of Cần Thơ, which is my hometown over in Vietnam. And he was in Saigon one day, and this is the way my mom told the story. A taxi driver picked him up, right? But the taxi driver spoke zero English, like not even a little bit. So as the taxi driver's driving, he sees my mom trying to wave him down on the side of the road. Now, normally, you're not supposed to pick up two different people on the same taxi. You know, that's just unprofessional. But he did it anyways, hoping that my mom would speak English and be able to like communicate. So the driver picked her up. So it's just them two in the back seat. And then they just start chopping it up. And my dad ends up getting her number, and the rest is history.
Well, and what was your mom doing at the time?
My mom was like a street seller, you know, the hustler.
Vendor.
I want to say she dropped out of high school in like 11th grade, and then was just like buying stuff, flipping it, you know, whatever it would be, clothes, food, goods, cigarettes, you know, just like a street vendor.
Yep, my dad's family's from Kangta.
Nice.
My father grew up in Kangta. It's a really quaint town, and you were born in Kangta, right?
Back in the day before it got as big as it is now, you
Yeah,
know.
it's a big place now. What and how old were you when you left?
Two.
So your father passed away before you left Vietnam,
No,
or?
no. He passed away the same year that we got here in the US. Yeah.
Oh man, I'm sorry to hear that. Like, and it was just like a sudden death.
It wasn't a sudden death, but the details on his death I don't really get into. Only like even like out of my close friends, I don't even think like more than a handful actually know. I'd probably say like two or three I've actually told. But yeah, just first year we came over here, he passed away, and it was just me and my mom for the first young years of my life.
Wow, man. I can't imagine how that growing up without, you know, your father, educated man, and you know how that has shaped your life.
How did it shape my
Yeah, how
life?
did it shape your life?
To be honest, I was too young to remember anything or know what's actually going on. I don't know. Honestly, like being at that age, just growing up with just a single mom, you don't really notice. Like you don't really pay attention. You're just like, oh, this is my care provider or whatever, and it's just my mom. So I was very attached to my mom, follow her everywhere around the house. But then as I grew up, I would say like elementary, that's when I kind of like start like realizing like, oh wait, people have two care providers, you know what I'm saying? Like a mom and a dad. So as a kid, because I did not think deeply into those type of ideas in that realm, it didn't really hit me, I would say, until middle school, where I was like, damn, like, you know, like a lot of kids out here are very lucky to have both parents, which is why, like, I'm very big on people like, yo, if you have an issue with your parents, like talk it out, you know, like,
Clear it
or at
up.
least be open to have that conversation of them, because not everyone's lucky to have that. But I was very lucky to have my mom, because my mom, man, everyone says I have the best mom in the world, right? So I'm not gonna say that, but my mom's a beast, bro. She did so much on her own, and that's kind of what it's just seeing that growing up, that's what gave me the drive and the motivation to do what I do, you know, because coming over here to the US, boom, year one, husband dies, have no one to lean on emotionally, have no one to lean on financially, barely speak English, you're taking care of a freaking 2-year-old, and the rest of your family's back in Vietnam that's hounding you to send money and help them out, you know? So like literally like from the ground up, you know, when he passed, the bank took the house and shit because like she couldn't afford to pay it. At the time, she was just a stay-at-home wife, and then now she has to find work and we have to find a place to live. So we were like couch hopping and stuff, but
And she knew nobody here.
she knew of people, but they weren't personal friends. It's like
Right.
someone in Vietnam had like either a friend or a family member that lived here. So it wasn't like love, you know what I mean? It was just
Yep.
more so like they helped because they felt bad because, you know, my mom was over here on her own.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information. It's incredible, man. But you know what? Sometimes, you know, these kinds of difficult stories shape the next generation. The receiver of the hard news, the receiver of the hard life gets emboldened into the second generation because they can see the things that you need to overcome in order to become successful. And I think that, you know, a lot of the second, third generation today, Vietnamese descendants, sometimes we don't have that fire inside of us because, you know, our parents worked so hard to give us what we got, and life has been a lot easier than your situation.
Yeah, 100%. I feel like my generation is very soft. So the way I explain to people, because of the way I grew up in a 100% Vietnamese household. So people be asking me like dumb shit, like, "Yo, are you more black? Or are you more Vietnamese?" I'm like, "Man, I was raised Vietnamese, you know." So my way of thinking is different. But because I'm in the young generation, I know how to communicate with them, and I understand where they're coming from and how they think. And you know, a lot of issues that our parents had to deal with was war, starvation, freaking sickness, you know, all that sort of stuff, right? Like real shit.
Real
But
struggles.
our generation, we have the luxury to worry about mental health and like words of affirmation and all this type of stuff, you know. And like, I'm not trying to knock it off, but it's like you're looking at it from one side of the fence without even trying to understand your parents, you know? And I understand that your parents are doing the same thing back to you, but it's like you went through trauma of freaking, I don't know, getting bullied in school or something. They went through trauma of bombs being dropped on them. You know what I'm saying? That's a big difference, bro. So I can understand a lot of the mindset of my generation, but I can't really relate to it because I don't agree. The only thing that I do is I just try to explain from the other point of view because I personally know how it is. Because growing up with my mom in the household, I went through the same thing you did, bro. You know, at one point, you just got to let it go and just like focus on giving back to them. You know what I'm saying? Like the effort, the work it took to come to America, birth your ungrateful ass, raise you, have you go to college, have you buy your first car, you know, whatever it is, like, is way greater than what you think you're entitled to. You know, that's just my opinion though.
No, I think it's a valid opinion. But you know, like the worst anybody goes through is the worst that they've ever been through, right? And so that's the tricky part of, I mean, I'm in that second generation. I'm like old, I'm almost 50, but I get it. And people like you get to see what it's like growing up in a hard way. And I'm part of that, like that entitled generation, where I thought that I had such a hard life. And then as I'm doing these interviews, I'm like, what the f like, I'm this spoiled kid with a silver spoon in my, and obviously we didn't grow up rich, but you know, now I could really see how difficult the second generation, when we are culturally separated from the hardship of war like our parents were, but you were like really close to it because, you know, you're born in Vietnam, and there's something like my brother was born in Vietnam, and there's something about like the thought of like, well, I was born in the homeland. And so it gives you sort of this distance of being part of that entitled second generation. For my brother, you know what I mean?
Not all the time. Not all the time. So it's not the fact that I was born in Vietnam or not born in Vietnam. It's the idea of assimilation, right? So assimilation is like, I guess you could use Americanized as a synonym, right? But assimilate is when you are another culture, but you are forced to live in this environment or this situation or this country, right? And you're forced to adapt. That's assimilating, right? And part of assimilating is also the mindset, the way of thinking. So in Asian countries, the mindset, they're collectivistic, meaning my life is not necessarily 100% about me. It's about my family. It's about my community. It's about my town, my city, my country. Over here, everything is individualistic. It's about me, 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 you know? Self-love, self-care. Oh, I need time to myself. Oh, I want to be unique. I want to be independent. That's why you have all these kids that, you know, move out and like do their own thing versus just keeping the family together. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to tell someone, yo, this is right and this is wrong. This is how I think. This is how I grew up. And this is the difference between us. And that's okay. You know, you choose which path you want to go on at the end of the day. Yeah.
And that's reflected in the way the governments are ran too. You know, when you think of like this collectivist sort of mentality, whether it's communist or not, like Asian governments, you know, have a sort of top down, you know, less individual way of looking at the way they run society. And it's different. It's so different when you're in Vietnam. And I don't want to get into hot water here, get into politics about this collectivist idea, but you know, as someone, you go back to Vietnam often, right?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I mean, would you say people in Vietnam are generally pretty happy, even in like the most poorest places?
Of course.
Right.
Yeah. Our family over there is like still going through the struggle, you know?
Yeah.
What's it called? So here's another difference. Like over here, we work 5 days a week just to look forward to the weekend, right?
Yeah.
Because, oh man, like I'm miserable. I work 5 days in a row. All right, fine. Finally, it's Friday. I'm gonna go hit the bars in the club, whatever. Over in Vietnam, man, they work every single day, but they party every single day. Like you enjoy just as much as you work. And I don't know. I think over here in America, there's just a whole lot of stresses and, you know, insecurities and just like things that create like mental stress and issues that is not found in Vietnam.
But so, you know, there's people here that would argue, because I preach that what you just said, but they would argue that, oh, because we're just visiting and we have money and we're Americans, we don't really get to see the real life. But I'm like, no, I've spent months, I mean, weeks there. And no, this is really how people live in Vietnam. You know, the rural countryside, people play every day. People eat every day. It's just a lot less pressure.
Yeah. And like the thing about that, like people say that, oh, it's because you're visiting. Oh, it's because you're American. Yeah. But like, live there like for like 3 months. I guarantee you, like you'll have a different mindset. Don't go to the city now. Go to like the countryside. And then you'll really see, because over here, if I were to go to, I don't know, two houses down from my house, knock on the door, they're going to ignore me. You know what I mean? They like, that's how people are nowadays. Everyone has Ring doorbells. Everyone, like nobody opens a door for like shit like that. Like, oh, what do you want? You know, over in Vietnam, like, you know, all your neighbors, bro, like everyone's close. You feel me? You walk over. Hey, you trying to go drink? Hell yeah. Like, hey, I bring over some beers. Like it's very, everything's more close. You feel more just like connected with like your town, your city, your street, whatever.
But that's probably what's going on in the Midwest and in America though too. Middle America is probably like that in the small towns, the rural
community. Yeah. So like, yeah, think small town mentality. Small town. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows everyone. Everyone's close. The community helps each other. That's exactly the feeling that I have when I'm in Vietnam.
You know what? And it shows up in your lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, because I understand Vietnamese you know, I listen and I'm like, this is crazy for some young man to really understand what goes on that not surface level, like bling bling, jewelry, Lamborghini level, but it's like on a deep level of kind of explaining what you're seeing on the countryside as you're living inside of it. And, you know, I've always wanted to talk to you about that stuff because it's like, you know, in order to have that kind of perspective and bring it out, somewhere along the line, you had to kind of have a developing love for seeing that kind of stuff. And then you were then going to put the words into music. But I want to know, before you put the words into music, where did that love of the culture, the countryside, come from?
I left Vietnam, but Vietnam never left me. That's the simplest way I can put it. If you ask anyone that's from Minh Thai in Vietnam, Minh Thai, which is like the Western region. So there's three official regions. There's North, Central, South, but the unofficial fourth region is the West, which is like, it's unofficial because on a map, you can't point it out because it's a part of the South, but the culture, the people, the way of life is so different. We just created our own region. So it's the West region, but that to me is like the most Vietnamese experience anyone can get just living in like the Western region. You just wake up in the morning, go get your coffee, get your cigarette, you know, talk some shit with the boys at the shop. All right, cool. I'm gonna just go home and just take a nap, wake up, go eat some pho at night, go karaoke. Or if you just want to just like literally just go fishing, go swimming in the pond, you know, you maybe have a farm at the house, tend to your like your animals and stuff. And, you know, it's just very simple.
Very
it's
simple,
simple but it's so fun. It's so happy, bro. You know?
And I mean, you can argue that it's like, you know, Minh Thai music and country, American country, all of it is, you know, very similar in terms of the simple life.
Yeah, I would say that's comparable. Like the soul behind American country music is like reflected in bolero you know, Vietnamese music. Yeah.
And now country music and rap music, both I think in America and in Vietnam, there's a lot of parallels with rap and country music. And what I mean by that is, I mean, you're starting to see the crossover of rap inside of country music inside of rap on the pop music stations. And I think a lot of that crossover happens. It's for me, when I listen to your music, it's like there's a crossover there, you know, that you're not rapping about city lights and you're not rapping about the things that are happening in Saigon, but you're talking about the things that the beautiful, simple things that are happening in the countryside of Cần Thơ or where you're from.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, for sure. Honestly, man, like it's probably not as deep as you're like imagining it. Like when I write the song, I just write the song. Like sometimes like I'll have like an intended purpose for this song when I release it. But like I was just talking about just Vietnam, just my experience in Vietnam, my lifestyle in Vietnam. It's just very simple and just having fun with it. Like that video that blew up, that has like a million views now, Việt Nam Xin Chào. Like I was just talking about Vietnamese people and Vietnamese culture, but from my POV, which is Minh Thai, you know what I'm saying? But I was showing love to like the different areas in Vietnam. I said, Hà Nội, Đà Nẵng, you know what I mean? Like that's the North and the Central region. So
I think what makes it complicated for me is I could have never imagined that this would have happened from an American perspective, right? Like the songwriting happened from an American person who went back to Vietnam, the roots, and then started rapping about these things. But your flows are like, it's just an American style, but now it's like you could hear all of that Vietnamese. So it's complicated to me because, you know, it's hard to imagine like that has happened, but it's happened in real life. So for me, I'm like, wow, it's just very special to me.
Oh no, man. And like the funny thing, man, it's happened 20 times over. You got C-Rock, you got GQ Fam, you got Antonius Maximus, you got Baby Red, you got, you know, you have all these guys right now. Like the Vietnamese American hip hop scene is coming up, and they're starting to like do more collabs over in Vietnam and messing with like Asian Vietnamese melody type beats, and they're finding that crossover. You know, I wouldn't say like I'm the first one to do it, but it is like a style that I'm exploring more, bringing like the Asian Vietnamese samples and like the melodies crossover into American I guess you could say hip hop like drum patterns, and you know, and just making it like, oh damn, I was saying like,
I'm glad you brought those guys up. GQ's been on the podcast. Antonius has been on the podcast. I've known Antonius, I mean, for a lot way before like I even gotten to the podcasting world. But Antonius used to live in LA, and so we used to hang out quite a bit. And you're right. When I think about Antonius, because I just get blinded by this idea. When I think of Antonius, I think of Black Eyed Peas, because that's sort of like the kind of pop style that he was doing for a long time, and he lived in Saigon. But when I think about it, you're right. He's from Minh Tây, and he raps about that quite a bit in his years ago. He used to rap quite a bit about it, and it reminds me. You're right. It does. And I totally discounted that, and I feel bad for not thinking about Antonius in that way. But GQ, I don't know. GQ seems more like a city rapper from San Diego. But I haven't heard his stuff coming from the
Real
countryside.
quick, real quick. I just want to chime in and just say this. I want to shout out Antonius one time, man. And Antonius literally booked me on like my first out of state show. First out of state show, because you know I'm based in Tampa, Florida, but I ain't never been booked in other states. So me and him, we just did a collab on the song called "Bun Bù Đời," and we're just talking about just like Minh Tây shit, you know, whatever. And he put together a show in San Jose. He started this show called "Bùi Đời by Night," like a spinoff of "Paris by Night." But he put me on the lineup, flew me out, housed me, paid me, fed us, and that I felt like was like a catalyst that just launched me into like these different areas and people and stuff like
So
that.
he
So
was the one who put you on the map outside of your state.
outside, he's the one that put me on my first paid show.
Shout out
Shout
to Antonius.
out Antonius, the OG.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad to hear. I mean, he was, when he was living in LA, he was partying with like some big names in hip hop. You know, Kid
It
and
ain't.
Play. You remember Kid and Play?
Yeah, I remember Kid and Play. Damn, that's old. I have their cassettes.
Old. He was hanging out with them. I mean, it was like when Kid and Play, I think it was Kid
Hey
that was doing
man,
it.
let's not drop Antonius' age now.
Yeah. Well, so we're talking about festivals and booking and all that other stuff. You know, recently you were if you're open to talking about it, you were booked for a Sobriety Fest event. Can we talk a little bit about that or a lot about it?
I'm so glad you asked. Yeah. What do you yeah, shoot.
Okay, so what is that festival? What is that festival focus on?
So Sobriety Fest, from what they say, is a cultural Southeast Asian festival that focuses on community and unity. So Southeast Asian food vendors. The whole entertainment lineup is all Southeast Asian. So, you know, rappers, singers, DJs, dancers, that sort of stuff.
And how long have they been around?
Me personally, I don't know, but as far as their group and their collective, like how many events they've done, I don't know. But as far as like the bigger scale, what we know as Sobriety Fest, this is only their second one.
And then when you were coming up, a few years ago, and you heard about this festival, was it a big thing to you? Like, was it a badge of honor to be invited or anything
Not
like that?
really. So sobriety is actually a Laos term. It means like hello or how are you doing. So it's geared toward Lao and Thai because they're more like closely related. Last year they it was Lao, Thai, and Hmong people, and this year they added Cambodian. But it didn't really stand out to me. For example, when we got involved, which I wasn't the one on the team to reach out, it was homegirl on our team. She's like, "Hey, I reached out to Spidey Fest," because she's Cambodian, right? And she wanted to have a meeting as far as like how we can get involved and help them out and whoop de whoop. And then I was just like, "Eh, like whatever. Sure, you want me on the meeting call? Cool, that's fine." So it never really stuck out to me because it's very closed off to everything else, you know? So if it's called Sabai D, which is a Lao term, how is that being able to be applied to Vietnamese or Filipino or Cambodian? Or say we go outside of Southeast Asian, you're just gonna say fuck you to Korean people, Japanese, Chinese, whatever. So yeah, it didn't really strike me at all, but I just did it just because I wanted to back her up, back up my team. And then when on the second meeting that I was not a part of, she volunteered me to perform, thinking that like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get Miyagi on the lineup. He's gonna be super. And when she told me, I was just like, I guess. I mean, are they paying? No? All right, I guess. But like, these are like the details and stuff that I did not include in the YouTube video for my own reasons.
Yeah, but if this is a homegirl that's on your team, right? And what shouldn't she clear all this stuff with you before she, reaches out and all that?
She owns a nonprofit. She's a founder of a nonprofit, which I was a part of. I decided it was best for me to take a step back away from that just so they don't get backlash from like all the stuff I've been posting about sobriety. But at the end of the day, she doesn't have experience in business. She doesn't have experience in artist management. Like, she's not my manager or anything. So it's like, in her head, she felt like it was good enough to just get on the lineup. You know what I mean? But she doesn't understand that there's a lot that goes into like this music shit, you know? I've put in $40,000 into music myself between studio, promo, shirts, flights, gas, all this stuff, right? But like, yeah, she just did, she literally just said, I didn't think of that. So I'm like, all right, well, we can't negotiate it now because you already made the deal without me. So just to save face for her and them, I just went through with it because she that was a part of the deal that she made. Oh, get Miyagi on the lineup, and now if Miyagi backs out, now I'm gonna make her look bad. You know what I'm saying? Because they
Yeah.
already made room for me on the lineup. They already put me on the flyer and did all this. So yeah.
So, all right. So tell me now, how many artists were on the lineup and how many, what is the inequity that we are looking at here with that festival organization?
As far as how many artists? I didn't count. I would probably say about around 20 artists per day. As far as the inequity, the list goes on. It's endless. First and foremost, it's about unity, right? That's their mission statement is a unity. But when it's called Sabai D Fest, it's only geared towards a certain crowd. And I have a lot of love for Lao people down here in Florida, like over in St. Pete, like they're involved with us so much and we're friends, we're family. I showed up to the Lao homies' freaking daughter's high school graduation. You know what I mean? I got love for everybody because me, at the end of the day, I'm mixed myself. I'm diverse as hell. And I don't really just mess with Asians, I mess with, Black folks, white folks, Hispanic, whatever you are, as long as you carry yourself in the right way. It's a character thing. So I felt like they're not really truly representing Southeast Asia because there's only a select few countries, because there's Vietnamese, there's Filipino, there's other ethnic minority groups, Malaysia, Singapore, you know what I mean? There's all these Southeast Asian countries, but you're only gonna have this, and this,
But
you know?
did their sort of like their mission statement say, hey, we're gonna like open it up and support everybody, or
Correct. So it's like they say a lot of stuff like, hey guys, this is for us. This is about us. This is our people. But who is our people? You know what I'm saying? Like you ask 10 different people who is our people, you're gonna get 10 different answers. But if you're promoting it as a Southeast Asian country,
got it.
why are you not including all of Southeast Asians? So It's very, so last year, the main turnout, I would say the main people demographic that turned out, I would say Lao and Hmong. Whereas this year it was Lao and Cambodian. They went hard on the Cambodian, which, I said in my video, we were the ones that brought over the Cambodian artists. Yeah. So on top of that, seeing the whole festival being run, because I do festivals myself, right? We do the Saigon night market over in Florida. I'm one of the co-founders, and we've been doing it for only a year, but we've gained so much traction, so much support, and we actually include, as many cultures and people as we can. Not just Asian. Like, you have Americans that show up to the festivals, But at Sobriety Fest, I'm walking around and I'm looking at it from the perspective of an organizer, because I understand that side of the fence. And just seeing the amount of staff, the amount of videographers, DJs, dancers, artists, just people involved in actually making the festival great, not getting compensated, not getting paid, like not even taking care of like their bare minimum. It just like yo, like how is this about community and culture and unity? Because you're running off of freaking, 70, 80% volunteers. You know what I'm saying? Oh yeah, come through, do it for the culture. All right. Well, if your fest is profiting millions, like a successful festival or a successful event period is when you double up. So Kenneth, you throw an event, it costs you 50 grand, you made 100 grand. Boom. Amazing. That you doubled up. 100 grand after taking away your expenses and all that. Man, I did the math on sobriety. The numbers are insane, man. The numbers are too high for you to keep running off of volunteers and asking people to come out and do it for the culture and not take bare minimum. I'm not charging them an arm and a leg, right? I tell them my rate, and I'm like, fly me out, house me. That's it. And because I'm gonna end up spending all of that anyways. You know what I mean? Because I'm bringing my whole team. So end of the day, I'm not gonna profit. But considering what us as a collective and a team did for freaking them, it's like, we man, it was beyond like. It was beyond out of love. It was not for the culture. It was not voluntary. It was purely getting taken advantage of, because at the end of the day, if I am able to pay you, I will. That's just how I am. Before I make my pockets fatter, I will make sure everyone gets taken care of. But for them, as an organization, generating all this money but still not taking care of people, that's the issue I have with it. So everyone looks at me, watches the video, they're like, oh, you're just mad about the money. You're just mad because you didn't get paid. No, you fucking idiot. Like, look at the fucking principle. You know what I'm saying? It's not about the money. It's about the fact that they use the words culture and unity to pull you dumbasses in to think that this is for the culture. But really, they're making hella money. Like, they got like, what, I want to say like 50 influencers, Southeast Asian influencers across the US. Boom. All right, y'all. Share our flyer, do this, do that, do a promo code, and yeah, we'll give you two free tickets to get in. What the fuck? They're already supposed to be there. How, like, of course they're gonna get free tickets, you idiot. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to fly them out. You have to pay them, because at the end of the day, they are promoting the fuck out of your festival. You know what I mean? There's no promoter works for free. You go to a club, what promoter does not get paid by the club? You know what I'm saying? And it's like the fact that they kind of forced everyone to do this whole promo code like thing, like commission thing. Like, hey, you sell one ticket, you get $20 off it. So if you sell, 100 tickets, you get 2,000. Doesn't that sound good? No, that doesn't fucking sound good, because the demographic is Southeast Asian. So say you have one Cambodian influencer, right? And the whole Cambodian population follow all these other influencers. Which one are they going to support and buy the ticket from? It makes it difficult. It makes it messy. Yo, limit the amount of people involved, pay them, and throw a good event. On the next festival, cycle through people. Don't have the same people come through. Give other people the opportunity. Give other countries the opportunity. You know what I'm saying? These are just very quick run through of like the issues I have with Sobriety Fest.
Did you see any of this going in?
Oh yeah, 100%. I saw it going in, but one, I already committed to doing it. You know what I mean? And two, I really wanted to see for myself in person. So I was really trying to give them the benefit of the doubt, because I heard, I saw the whole Reddit that the Hmong people made about Sobriety Fest. I've heard this, heard that, but like, you know what? I'm gonna go in with a kind of clearer mind and
Open
just,
mind,
open mind and see it for myself. And
Now,
yeah.
have you had a chance to talk with the organizers? Have they reached out?
One organizer, I forgot his name. I'm probably not gonna name drop though, but he reached out. He was like, "Hey, what's with all this hate you're giving us, bro?" I'm like, "Bro, it's not hate. I'm just being honest because someone has to say it. You know what I'm saying?" And he goes, "Oh, do you want to have a discussion about it?" And that was, one of the influencers, not like the other main influencers. That was like, I would say like a notch, two notch down type of manager type guy. But no, I was like, "No, I'm not really interested in having this conversation because you guys saw all of this unfold before your fucking eyes. You know what I mean? Like, what's the point in having the conversation after I post this video? You know what I mean? You didn't have conversations with all those Hmong artists that like were speaking up last year. You know what I'm saying? Why do you want to talk to me? Oh, because the video is getting traction and you're actually getting backlash for the first time in your life. So yeah, I wasn't really interested. For me, it's just a purely like loss of respect thing, because that's the type of person I am. If I don't respect you, I won't even waste like my breath, you know?
Yeah, I mean, God, I think of myself as you're telling me the story. If I was in the situation of the organizers, many times they're busy trying to put this together. I'm just playing devil's advocate, like having blind sides of, you don't think about what the expenses, we don't think about what the expenses are. Yeah, and I know that you've been on the event organizing side. And I think by them sort of like pulling all this stuff that we as people who are in the event organizing space, sometimes we could see. But at the same time, I'm like, I really wonder if they are people who are like bad actors at this organizing stuff and they're really pocketing and taking advantage of people, or perhaps they're just bad business guys who are kind of operating really without any sense of what their expenses are compared to what they should be paying artists and, all these volunteers and stuff, I really wonder what goes on in their mind.
Yeah, for sure. We all wonder that those are the answers that we all want, And I'm not talking about just me and my team. I'm talking about every other person that was undervalued, not paid, and mistreated at Sobriety. You know what I mean? There's a bunch of firsthand accounts, people that reached out to me personally, DM me. I would post their stories and their comments on like my story on Instagram, but I would like scribble out their name or their profile picture because they just don't want to like deal with the backlash and the
Yeah.
hate from, because being the one to go against a cultural festival, you're gonna have half people support you and half people against you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I
Oh,
do.
like, bro, I've been dealing with it for like a week now. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just kind of numb to it at this point because I had a lot of people come forward and speak on that. So I'm like, all right, I'm not crazy. It's not just me. You know what I'm saying? There's a real issue here, and it's an issue that's not being addressed. And if it's not being addressed by the people, it damn sure ain't gonna be addressed by Sobriety, you
Right,
know? So
right.
just like how you said, I came in with a open mind. I'm like, you know what? Maybe no. There's no way, bro. Like at my festivals, dog, if I have time to book these artists, fly them out, make sure they're taken care of, host them, manage the stage, do tickets, bring water and food to people, escort people in, fucking, dump trash, like bins of trash, go make supply runs to the store for beer, water. Like, there's no way I can do all that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm half these people's age. You know what I'm saying? Like, man, yeah, I just don't like the way they move. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad that you have, the capacity to speak up on it and to really open it up, because that takes a lot of mental energy, to really be able to deal with the backlash of what you're getting up on online.
Yeah, and like from what I observed at Sobriety, The organizers pretty much had a team of like managers, like everywhere, where it's like they would, they had a stage crew, they had a staff crew, they had security crew, they had media crew, but the organizers themselves were not overseeing any of it. They were just walking around, taking pictures, drinking, having a good time. I'm like, bro, when I'm at my festivals, I'm working, bro. I'm sweating as hard as anyone there. You know what I mean? Because if you're not working as hard as your workers, you know what I mean? Like, who's gonna lead? Who's gonna set the example? Who's gonna make sure it runs smooth? Who's gonna make sure that everyone leaves happy? You know what I mean? Like, imagine the impact it'll have on, like, say you have a trash crew, right? And yeah, you're paying them to go dump trash, but what are you doing right now? You're just standing around, you're walking around looking cool. Imagine the impact you would have on your workers and your team if you could just help. Like, yo, bro, you get that bin, I'll get this bin. We'll get it done twice as fast. That's community. That's unity. You know what I mean? I don't know, man. I can go
Yeah.
on for days about sobriety, man.
No, and I like the conversation we're having. I think it's very controversial right now in this present moment to just get one side, which is your side, Miyagi. It's, one side. But at the same time, I know that, the experience that you have as an organizer, I've been on the organizing side with events as well. And I understand that there are things that we could be doing instead of standing around drinking. And the observations that you have, they sound like they come from a place of a real fairness, it sounds like. And I want to ask a few more questions, if that's okay.
Please do, go ahead.
Now, in terms of communities like Vietnamese and Chinese, Taiwanese, Cambodians, we have often these issues of working together. And it's both within our niches and on the general Southeast Asian side. When and how do we get together to make these things better? How can we make it better?
For one, I think the way Sobriety Fest is trying to push the idea of unity is extremely difficult to do,
Why?
because for example, right, people only come together when there is a common enemy. So for example, the Asian hate crimes during COVID, right? Now all the Asians are together. Doesn't matter, Southeast, Far East, we all came together because it was an Asian thing. After that died down, now what? All right, everyone just goes back to their own people. At the end of the day, unity is extremely, it's a idea that you're gonna really have to think fully out and focus on that demographic for what type of event you're throwing. If it's gonna be a Southeast Asian culture festival, throw in all of the Southeast Asians, but just know Chinese, Japanese, Korean, they're gonna look at you all twisted because now you're shutting them out, So it's like, my opinion, I think it would be better if you're gonna do the unity card, just do Asian, just do Asian, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, whatever. We're all together. Even though we all have our own differences, you know what I mean? That is just a bigger umbrella to fit people under, just so there aren't as many issues with favoritism and jealousy and all that. Do a name, that's not like canceling other people out. Because, for example, like I said, sobriety, that is a Laos term, right? Me, in my opinion, I try not to push the whole unity card because it can be a double-edged sword. So the model I tend to throw is culture, community, and diversity. We celebrate diversity. You know what I'm saying? At the end of the day, we really don't have to be best friends. We don't have to get along, you know what I'm saying? But each culture has something unique and different to bring to the table. And I want to celebrate that. I want to celebrate our differences because that's what makes you you. You know what I'm saying? That's that. And I'm mixed. I'm literally Nigerian and Vietnamese. So I embody that idea. So that's kind of more so the route I want to take because every people have their own culture. And when you say terms like culture and unity and our people, all right, but who does that apply to? These
Yeah.
are I you have to think throughout before just saying.
I grapple with that question all the time because, you know, obviously I'm interested in the Korean culture, you know, the Japanese culture, Chinese, Taiwanese culture, Singaporean, but, and Cambodian, Laotian, but I don't have in three lifetimes to go and research all of those cultures. I don't even have enough time to research just the Vietnamese culture globally, right? What we're doing globally. I don't even have one enough lifetime. And somebody, a close friend of mine, called me out a few months ago, was like, you know, shouldn't you be fighting for the Cambodians and the Laotians and the unity and being closer? I'm like, yeah, I should. I think it's good, but we only have one lifetime. You have to kind of pick a lane. So whenever I think about this sort of this idea of unity and this sort of reaching out across the aisle to help another culture out, I'm like, the Vietnamese community, we still are building our own entertainment and education infrastructure here in present moment. So when I think about like a festival or anything, it's just probably going to be the Vietnamese, because I think that we still need a lot of focus on our own culture.
Right. Yeah. And that's a fair thought. And, you know, there's a million different perspectives on this. But yeah, at the end of the day, when it comes to like throwing an event, like I said, you really have to think that idea and concept through, because it is deeper than just words. You know, now you're touching people's like souls, because like their culture is who they are. That's who they embody. And if like you make a certain, you know, group or groups feel excluded, you know, that's where the issues arise. Because like I said, like people really only unite when there's a common enemy. The example I gave was the Asian hate crimes during COVID. All the Asians come together. If freaking aliens were to attack the fucking earth, of course all humans are going to come together. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, man, it's you have to tread light.
Yeah. It's hard. It's a hard game to play. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
That's a deeper question. To me, being Vietnamese is all about resilience, you know? And I would even say that for a lot of Southeast Asian countries, because Vietnam throughout history has always been at war with somebody. And, you know, right now, I think we just celebrated the 50th year of the Vietnam War, like afterward or whatever. And, you know, this is the first 50 years of peace we had throughout history. We've always had war. And of course, after the fall of Saigon, everyone left, went to refugee camps, settled in different places in the world. But at the end of the day, they still maintain like that resilience. It's like that hardness that they've built up from that. And, you know, it carries on into some of the younger generation as well. So to me, being Vietnamese is, you know, just being resilient, being proud of where you're from. And yeah.
Very cool. And, you know, you rap in both languages, Vietnamese and English. Do you feel like you are a different person when you're rapping in Vietnamese, or a different person when you're rapping in English?
No, I'm the same person, just different language that I convey myself through.
But it doesn't feel like a different lens that you're looking through when you're speaking or rapping in a different language.
No, maybe for some, you know, like
for me, I have a weird feeling. I feel like I'm a different person when I'm speaking Vietnamese. There's just a little bit more of kind of control, kind of censorship when I speak Vietnamese. But when I speak English, you know, I'll go off the deep end in English. And I don't know what it is. It's just a personality thing, I think, for me. But I'm trying to like fuse the two together to make it kind of just be real in either language. But I experienced it. That's why I asked the question.
I've never really experienced that. To me, it's just, I'm just the same person. The way I think is the way I think. But how I communicate it doesn't matter, whether Vietnamese or English, you know?
Yeah. And you said you put a lot of money into your music, but that means that you have operated and you work outside of the music industry in order to finance the music that you've done. And I hate asking this, but your day job?
I do a few things. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah. All right. Now, what about in terms of like time management? Because I think as artists, there's a lot of things that we always think about, multiple projects, multiple songs. There's probably different stages of music and songs that you're in development or finalizing, trying to figure out which song is going to pop off, which event to do. There's a million directions as artists. We have a lot of freedom to do and to monetize and stuff like that. How do you figure out what's priority and how do you keep on track with the work that you do?
Man, I don't know where it's at, but I literally have a notebook somewhere, like a small little notebook that I just write stuff down and it's, I just checklist, bam, 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 like that. Just like not like just music in itself is like one thing, one area of life. But then I have work, then I have friends, then I have family, then I have, you know, responsibilities like taking care of the house and this and that and the third. Time management is just time management. I think if you're you know, an adult, you know, that's just a skill that you're going to have to learn to achieve. At the end of the day, priority is my well-being, my people's well-being, and also just working on the next thing, you know, making money as well. As far when it comes to projects, it's, you know, it's difficult, but it's doable, you know, because for example, if I have five people in a week ask me to do a song, realistically, it takes me time to write the song, takes me time to record it, set in the vocal, and that's only just for one person, you know? So I can't deliver as much as I want to in the time frame that I'd like to. But eventually I get to everyone. And yeah, it's just about the grinding and hustling. I believe if you want it bad enough, you'll just get it done. Yeah.
I'm gonna ask this question for all the young artists out there. How long did it take you to finally feel like you were doing what you were meant to be doing?
To be honest with you, this year.
And so how long has that been?
I would say I really started like messing with music. I don't even want to say messing with music. Let me say like at least the music aspect of it, yeah. Taking it seriously. Recently, I've taken the business side of it more seriously, but as far as the music making process, mm-hmm. taking it seriously, like when I was 19, 20. So okay. Probably I'm 25 now. So like 5, 6 years.
5, 6 years. Okay. So when did you say that I am going to do this seriously? So that was 19, right? When you said, I'm going to do this seriously, the music part of it?
Oh yeah, yeah. So 19, yeah, like 19, 20, I was like, yo, I love music. I'm a treat it like a hobby and have fun with it. As of recent this year, I like music. I love music. How can I make a living off of it? that's the difference between the mentality now. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so why do you think in those years before you made that switch in the mentality, why do you think that you couldn't make that judgment on your business or your music business earlier? Why couldn't you say maybe after 2, 3 years, you're like, I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna make money and I'm gonna make a life from this?
To be honest, at the time, I just didn't believe in myself. I was still in college. So I'm thinking like, I mean, the whole point of me going to college is to freaking get a job after, right? So if the music thing takes off, then I'll leave my job. I ended up graduating and stuff. And I don't know. I just being that young, I just didn't see that far, you know. But as I've been sticking with the music all these years, it's just been steadily building up, building up, building up. And I feel like I finally reached a breakthrough point where I think I can actually do this for real. So yeah, I would say short answer was just overthinking, self-doubt. Back then, you know, and lack of, you know, motivation, that I had like a bunch of recent life events happen lately. And that's what kind of gave me my newfound spark. Like I found that hunger again, you know. It's like, say like a businessman that started from nothing and he becomes a millionaire or something. He might lose motivation. He might lose some of that fire. He's like, all right, well, damn, I made it. Put him in a bad situation again. He's going to find that spark again, you know. That's exactly what happened to me.
How much work do you do in Vietnam with music?
I have a lot of friends, music artist friends over there. Whenever we're able to collab, you know, we collab. I have a lot coming up, but when I'm over in Vietnam or the people I talk to in Vietnam, usually we just chop it up. We talk about future plans. We talk about
Have
what
you
we want.
performed in Vietnam?
No, I've never
Not
performed.
yet.
Not yet.
Are
No,
you looking forward to it?
I've been waiting. I've been waiting for the debut, and the debut is coming, and it's going to be grand. I promise.
So it is in place.
Yes.
Can you talk about when we should expect a
Yeah,
debut film?
I don't like to speak prematurely because
Okay.
I'm still in like the negotiation process of it,
But it's coming.
but let's just say it's a rap show in Vietnam. Let's just say
Okay.
that.
That sounds exciting. And with your last few years of working, because you know quite a bit of the Vietnamese American rap artists and then the artists in Vietnam, what are some of the similarities and some of the differences of the artists?
Similarities, they're all dope, they're all unique. They have their own styles, and they all have like the love for just making music and just
Yeah.
doing dope shit. The differences is the same reason. They're unique, you know what I mean? They have something different to bring to the table. The American rappers, their lyrical content and their mindset, is it brings different sustenance in their music than like Vietnamese, So like I kind of dabble in both because like you won't really have like Vietnamese Americans rapping about like Minh Tai and stuff or whatever, but they're really talking about more like hustle type of like Cali hustle type of lifestyle. That's the content in their music. Whereas in Vietnam, you have, you branch out, you do other stuff, but yeah, at end of the day, like the music scene in Vietnam is very sophisticated, and like people don't realize that. Like, if there's a whole freaking rap show or multiple rap shows on hip hop in Vietnam, like that says something. And it's a trending genre and topic right now in Vietnam is rap and hip hop. But yeah, I think there will always be like a difference in how we go about like making music, because like me, I'm more grounded in hip hop as a culture, which not necessarily means like the genre of music. Like, where did hip hop start from? So hip hop was literally born from a group of people that were oppressed. It's a genre of music that screams for freedom and independence and saying how you feel and channeling your emotions through DJing and MCing and graffiti and b-boy and all that type of stuff. So I'm more so on like the culture aspect of it versus how you were saying earlier, oh, you don't really talk about like money, cars, and city life. Yeah, it's not really me, but if you do that, that's cool.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I respect that. And this might be a touchy question, but who are some of the art you've already named some Vietnamese American ones, but what about the ones in Vietnam that we typically don't know about, that we don't hear about? Can you name off some names that we should be tuning into that you follow?
Sure, for sure. Hustling Robber, that's the homie out in Da Nang. He does like drill type of style, like trap drill type of style. Cat from the north named Wardy, super fire. Blacka down in Saigon, with G Family. He's a spitter, man. He's a spitter. Like lyrically, very few people can touch him. Dat Maniac, of course. Dat Maniac is kind of referred to like the Eminem of Vietnamese hip hop.
Wow.
Another crazy
That's a
spitter.
big name. That's a
Yeah.
big
Yep.
that's big
Yep. And
shoes to.
if you listen to his music, like you can't deny it. What's it out in my area? Like Minh Tai and stuff. You got Lang LD. You got Jambi. Ricky Starr. Bebo. Man, I can go on and on. Like I listen to a lot of them. Yeah.
Yeah, and you didn't name any of the commercial rappers that
Oh,
we.
you mean like Binz and Dang
Yeah.
Bao, those type of guys? Yeah,
Yeah,
they're cool. They're cool.
yeah. The big names, but I guess the big names are what commercial sort of like in America.
It's like what people want to hear. But like I said, like I come from hip hop as the culture, you know what I mean? And like, I'm just more drawn to specific things. I don't really listen to like mainstream stuff, even American stuff. I don't listen to mainstream. I listen to all underground, all raw, just unique, super dope stuff. You know, I don't want to hear something that's been played a million times on the radio, and then a new up and coming artist just makes a different version of that song.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking? Yeah, I like variety.
But somebody like Kendrick Lamar is not somebody who's coming from a cookie cutter pattern, right? He's his own sort of like, I mean, for me, modern rap is Kendrick Lamar. You know, it's just a bright shining star who's just head full of uniqueness.
You can say that, like, that's an opinion, you know. At the end of the day, me, I've always like all these big artists now that came up through the grind, you know, like for example Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole, right? I'm always a fan of their older stuff more versus now their stuff is commercialized, you know. It's very mainstream e unpopular opinion, I'm not the biggest fan of Kendrick Lamar. I think he's okay. You know, he has good songs lyrically. He's very well, but he's just not my taste, you know.
But what is it that specifically when you said the modern Kendrick Lamar is more commercial, like what is the difference between the old stuff and the new stuff?
So when you are broke, right, and you have no money and you're trying to chase this music career, you're in a different mindset. Right, you're in a different mind state. All your lyrics are coming straight from your heart. When you get to a certain level where you have money, you have all that, and at this point, you're just trying to maintain it. Now you have ghostwriters, now you have this, now you have that. You have more perks at your hand that the aspect of it is just to pump out music to keep making money, you know. And you know, that's not me trying to like say that I know anything about the music industry. This is just my opinion, but yeah, I think, once artists make it to a certain level, it just stops being about the music and more about the money. Just like that.
Yeah, I can't really relate to that because I don't know Kendrick Lamar's music enough or Kanye's music, but I did remember there's a clear line in the sand for me when it went from like College Dropout and it was a graduation. It just felt different. The two first albums at Kanye West and then going into the third, fourth, and the later ones. You know, I don't know him or his journey well enough to say it's that hunger and that paper chase, but there is a definite difference in the caliber of the relatability of Kanye's first two albums compared to three, four, five, six, seven. You know, there's that I lost it. I lost the relatability to the family stuff that he wrote about, to the homies, you know. And I think that's what you feel all the way through. For me, with Tupac's music, you felt that camaraderie and the family and Dear Mama and all that stuff that you mentioned are written about when you don't have money, because the things that are important to you is just very different than when you do have the money.
Yeah, correct. And it's just like that. Yeah.
Never thought about that. So what makes you most excited about your present life?
What makes me most excited is always working on the next thing, you know? Like, 'cause people ask me, like, you know, what's your favorite song? My favorite song is the one that I'm working on right now that you have no idea about, you know? So yeah, what makes me most excited is just continuing on this journey, see where it takes me, seeing what kind of impact I will actually be able to make on the world, really. You know what I mean? Like, 'cause when I die, you know, I think about this a lot. It's like, what am I gonna leave behind? Do I want to leave behind just a gravestone, or do I want to leave behind podcasts and interviews and music and stuff that people will actually be able to like take a peek inside my head? You know, I really want to make a real impact on the world.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
that's what we're doing right now. Literally coming back year after year, month after month for you to come back and share with your growth and your journey is a way for us to get a peek into the development of who you become. Yeah, it's so important to have a lot of these podcasts and you know because I think that if there's like 10 people like me who are podcasting and you go on all 10 shows, you'll be asked different questions because everybody has their own curiosity, right?
No, yeah, for sure. And I'm super glad I got on this one, man. I know it's been like a long time in the works, but we made it. I felt like it was the right time. And yeah, let's just see where this road takes me, you
Yeah,
know?
no, I definitely see a huge feel. I saw when you first started, you know? I saw when you first started. It started when I reached out, you know, a long time ago. I saw it. And it's crazy to me because, you know, I think we all have our reasons for coming on or not coming on. And I think sometimes that coming on, a lot of artists felt, and they'll say it to me. They're like, you know, I don't feel like I have enough done, or I don't feel like I have enough to share, or I have a book coming out, whatever it is. But I always like to see an artist in its early phases as they're developing, and then get them on the show and on the podcast to talk about their lives as it's unfolding. So I want to, you know, let you know and extend that welcome to you, that whenever you have a new album or you have some new stuff, come back on the show and we could talk about, you know, your developing life.
Easy. I'm all for it, man.
Thank you. Thank you. I have one last question. How big do you feel is the Vietnamese American rap scene compared to sort of what's developing in Vietnam right now?
Over here in America, it's small. It's small. I can damn near name every single Vietnamese American artist off the top of my head. You know, it's small, but it's growing. It's growing. That's why you're seeing a lot of like rap shows being thrown here. Right now, the ones that are selling out are the ones that they're bringing, like the artists that they're bringing over from Vietnam, like the headliners. But eventually, it will get to a point where the Vietnamese American hip hop scene will be big enough to be self-sustaining without help from Vietnam. Because ultimately, Vietnamese rap started here in the US, and then Vietnam caught on. And then everyone in Vietnam started doing it. And then it blew up into this whole big thing to where the scene over there just trumps like what we got going on
It's
over
just
here.
a matter of population. They just have more people.
Exactly. Because where is Vietnamese rap going to do better at? In the US or in Vietnam? You know, of course, Vietnam.
And so what makes you get that? Where do you get the hope that it'll eventually exist without having to bring headliners from Vietnam?
I mean that's what we're doing right now. Me and all the homies over here, we're making a lot of moves, putting together shows, collaborating with artists over in Vietnam, just getting more people interested into Vietnamese rap because a lot of people thought it couldn't be done. If you're Vietnamese American and you listen to American rap, like why would you not listen to Vietnamese rap? Like why not? If you understand Vietnamese, you speak Vietnamese, you claim to be Vietnamese, like why would you not support your own people, you know? And there's always going to be a lane for that, and it's still growing, you know.
I
Still.
think back in the day, when you asked me that question, if I think back 15, 20 years ago and I think about Vietnamese rap, there's a level of cheesiness to it. And I'm not going to name names because, you know, there's no.
I already know who you're thinking of, man. I already know who you're thinking of.
You know,
Yeah.
and today, Vietnamese rap comes with a different sort of gravity. You know, there's a different level of oomph to the Viet rappers today. And
Yeah,
legacy.
it's no joke. Like at this point, it's not a joke. It's not a meme. It's like, yo, like no, this is hip hop. Like, yo, they got it. You know what I mean? You can look at it and be like, yo, they got it.
Something about it, something about the importance of its arrival today.
Yeah.
Miyagi, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and we hope to talk to you again very soon.
Be an honor. Thank you so much, Kenneth. It's been fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.